pride. How could such a vulgar devil visit such a great man as you? Yes, there's that romantic strain in you that was so derided by Bielinski. I can't help it, young man. As I got ready to come to you, I did think as a joke of appearing in the figure of a retired general who had served in the Caucasus, with the star of the Lion and the Sun on my coat. But I was positively afraid of doing it, for you'd have thrashed me for daring to pin the Lion and the Sun on my coat instead of, at least, the Polar Star or the Sirius. And you keep on saying I'm stupid, but mercy on us, I make no claim to be equal to you in intelligence. Mephistopheles declared to Faust that he desired evil, but did only good. Well, he can say what he likes. It's quite the opposite with me. I am perhaps the one man in all creation who loves the truth and genuinely desires good. I was there when the Word, who died on the cross, rose up into heaven bearing on his bosom the soul of the penitent thief. I heard the glad shrieks of the cherubim singing and shouting Hosanna, and the thunderous rapture of the seraphim which shook heaven and all creation. And I swear to you by all that's sacred, I long to join the choir and shout Hosanna with them all. The Word had almost escaped me, had almost broken from my lips. You know how susceptible and aesthetically impressionable I am. But common sense, a most unhappy trait in my character, kept me in due bounds, and I let the moment pass. But what would have happened, I reflected, what would have happened after my Hosanna? Everything on earth would have been extinguished at once, and no events could have occurred. And so, solely from a sense of duty and my social position, I was forced to suppress the good moment and to stick to my nasty task. Somebody takes all the credit of what's good for himself, and nothing but nastiness is left for me. But I don't envy the honour of a life of idle imposture. I'm not ambitious. Why am I, of all creatures in the world, doomed to be cursed by all decent people and even to be kicked? For if I put on mortal form, I'm bound to take such consequences sometimes. I know, of course, there's a secret in it, but they won't tell me the secret for anything, for then, perhaps, seeing the meaning of it, I might bawl Hosanna, and the indispensable minus would disappear at once, and good sense would reign supreme throughout the whole world. And that, of course, would mean the end of everything, even of magazines and newspapers. For who would take them in? I know that at the end of all things I shall be reconciled. I, too, shall walk my quadrillion and learn the secret. But till that happens, I'm sulking and fulfill my destiny, though it's against the grain. That is, to ruin thousands for the sake of saving one. How many souls have had to be ruined, and how many honourable reputations destroyed for the sake of that one righteous man, Job, over whom they made such a fool of me in old days? Yes, till the secret is revealed, there are two sorts of truth for me. One, their truth, yonder, which I know nothing about so far, and the other, my own, and there's no knowing which will turn out the better. Are you asleep? I might well be, Ivan groaned angrily. All my stupid ideas, outgrown, thrashed out long ago, and flung aside like a dead carcass. You present to me as something new. There's no pleasing you, and I thought I should fascinate you by my literary style. That Hosanna in the skies really wasn't bad, was it? And then that ironical tone, a la Heine, eh? No, I was never such a flunky. How then could my soul beget a flunky like you? My dear fellow, I know a most charming and attractive young Russian gentleman, a young thinker and a great lover of literature and art, the author of a promising poem entitled The Grand Inquisitor. I was only thinking of him. I forbid you to speak of the Grand Inquisitor, cried Ivan, crimson with shame. And the Geological Cataclysm, do you remember? That was a poem. Now, hold your tongue or I'll kill you. You'll kill me? No, excuse me, I will speak. I came to treat myself to that pleasure. Oh, I loved the dreams of my ardent young friends, quivering with eagerness for life. There are new men, you decided last spring, when you were meaning to come here. They proposed to destroy everything and begin with cannibalism. Stupid fellows, they didn't ask my advice. I maintain that nothing need be destroyed, that we only need to destroy the idea of a God in man. That's how we have to set to work. It's that we must begin with. Oh, blind race of men who have no understanding. As soon as men have all of them denied God, and I believe that period analogous with geological periods will come to pass, the old conception of the universe will fall of itself without cannibalism, and what's more, the old morality and everything will begin anew. Men will unite to take from life all it can give, but only for joy and happiness in the present world. Men will be lifted up with a spirit of divine, titanic pride, and the man God will appear. From hour to hour, extending his conquest of nature infinitely by his will and his science, man will feel such lofty joy from hour to hour in doing it, that it will make up for all his old dreams of the joys of heaven. Everyone will know that he's mortal, and will accept death proudly and serenely like a god. His pride will teach him that it's useless for him to repine at life's being a moment, and he will love his brother without need of reward. Love will be sufficient only for a moment of life, but the very consciousness of its momentariness will intensify its fire, which now is dissipated in dreams of eternal love beyond the grave. And so on in the same style. Charming? Ivan sat with his eyes on the floor and his hands pressed to his ears, but he began trembling all over. The voice continued. The question now is, my young thinker reflected, is it possible that such a period will ever come? If it does, everything is determined and humanity is settled forever. But as, owing to man's inveterate stupidity, this cannot come about for at least 1,000 years, everyone who recognizes the truth even now may legitimately order his life as he pleases on the new principles. In that sense, all things are lawful for him. What's more, even if this period never comes to pass, since there is anyway no God and no immortality, the new man may well become the man God, even if he is the only one in the whole world. And promoted to his new position, he may light-heartedly overstep all the barriers of the old morality of the old slave man, if necessary. There is no law for God. Where God stands, the place is holy. Where I stand will be at once the foremost place. All things are lawful. And that's the end of it. That's all very charming, but if you want to swindle, why do you want a moral sanction for doing it? But that's our modern Russian all over. He can't bring himself to swindle without a moral sanction. He's so in love with truth. The visitor talked, obviously carried away by his own eloquence, speaking louder and louder, and looking ironically at his host. But he did not succeed in finishing. Ivan suddenly snatched a glass from the table and flung it at the orator.
Ah, mais c'est bête enfin, cried the latter, jumping up from the sofa and shaking the drops of tea off himself. He remembers Luther's inkstand. He takes me for a dream and throws glasses at a dream. It's like a woman. I suspected you were only pretending to stop up your ears.
A loud, persistent knocking was suddenly heard at the window. Ivan jumped up from the sofa.
Do you hear? You'd better open, cried the visitor. It's your brother Alyosha with the most interesting and surprising news, I'll be bound.
Be silent, deceiver. I knew it was Alyosha. I felt he was coming, and of course he's not come for nothing. Of course he brings news.
Ivan exclaimed frantically.
Open, open to him. There's a snowstorm, and he is your brother. Monsieur, sait-il le temps qu'il fait? C'est à ne pas mettre un chien dehors.
The knocking continued. Ivan wanted to rush to the window, but something seemed to fetter his arms and legs. He strained every effort to break his chains, but in vain. The knocking at the window grew louder and louder. At last the chains were broken, and Ivan leapt up from the sofa. He looked round him wildly. Both candles had almost burnt out. The glass he had just thrown at his visitor stood before him on the table, and there was no one on the sofa opposite. The knocking on the window frame went on persistently, but it was by no means so loud as it had seemed in his dream. On the contrary, it was quite subdued.
"It was not a dream. No, I swear it was not a dream. It all happened just now," cried Ivan.
He rushed to the window and opened the movable pane.
"Alyosha, I told you not to come," he cried fiercely to his brother. "In two words, what do you want? In two words, do you hear?"
"An hour ago, Smerdyakov hanged himself."
Alyosha answered from the yard.
"Come round to the steps, I'll open at once," said Ivan, going to open the door to Alyosha.
Chapter 10. It was he who said that. Alyosha, coming in, told Ivan that a little over an hour ago Maria Kondratyevna had run to his rooms and informed him Smerdyakov had taken his own life. "I went in to clear away the samovar, and he was hanging on a nail in the wall." On Alyosha's inquiring whether she had informed the police, she answered that she'd told no one. "But I flew straight to you. I've run all the way." She seemed perfectly crazy, Alyosha reported, and was shaking like a leaf. When Alyosha ran with her to the cottage, he found Smerdyakov still hanging. On the table lay a note. "I destroy my life of my own will and desire, so as to throw no blame on anyone." Alyosha left the note on the table and went straight to the police captain and told him all about it. "And from him I've come straight to you," said Alyosha in conclusion, looking intently into Ivan's face. He'd not taken his eyes off him while he told his story, as though struck by something in his expression. "Brother," he cried suddenly, "you must be terribly ill. You look and don't seem to understand what I tell you."
"It's a good thing you came," said Ivan,
as though brooding and not hearing Alyosha's exclamation.
"I knew he'd hanged himself."
"From whom?"
"I don't know, but I knew. Did I know? Yes, he told me. He told me so just now."
Ivan stood in the middle of the room and still spoke in the same brooding tone, looking at the ground.
"Who is he?"
asked Alyosha, involuntarily looking round.
"He slipped away."
Ivan raised his head and smiled softly. "He was afraid of you, of a dove like you. You are a pure cherub. Dmitri calls you a cherub."
"Cherub, the thunderous rapture of the seraphim." "What are seraphim? Perhaps a whole constellation. But perhaps that constellation is only a chemical molecule. There's a constellation of the lion and the sun, don't you know it?"
"Brother, sit down," said Alyosha in alarm. "For goodness sake, sit down on the sofa. You're delirious. Put your head on the pillow. That's right. Would you like a wet towel on your head? Perhaps it'll do you good."
"Give me the towel. It's here on the chair. I just threw it down there."
"It's not here. Don't worry yourself. I know where it is. Here," said Alyosha, finding a clean towel folded up and unused by Ivan's dressing table in the other corner of the room. Ivan looked strangely at the towel. Recollection seemed to come back to him for an instant.
"Stay."
He got up from the sofa.
"An hour ago I took that new towel from there and wetted it. I wrapped it round my head and threw it down here. How is it it's dry? There was no other."
"You put that towel on your head?" asked Alyosha.
"Yes, and walked up and down the room an hour ago. Why have the candles burnt down so? What's the time?"
"Nearly 12.
"No, no, no,"
Ivan cried suddenly.
"It was not a dream. He was here. He was sitting here on that sofa. When you knocked at the window, I threw a glass at him. This one... Wait a minute. I was asleep last time, but this dream was not a dream. It has happened before. I have dreams now, Alyosha. Yet they're not dreams, but reality. I walk about, talk, and see, though I am asleep. But he was sitting here on that sofa there. He's frightfully stupid, Alyosha, frightfully stupid."
Ivan laughed suddenly and began pacing about the room. "Who is stupid? Of whom are you talking, brother?" Alyosha asked anxiously again.
"The devil. He's taken to visiting me. He's been here twice, almost three times. He taunted me with being angry at his being a simple devil and not Satan with scorched wings in thunder and lightning. But he is not Satan. That's a lie. He's an impostor. He's simply a devil, a paltry, trivial devil. He goes to the baths. If you undressed him, you'd be sure to find he had a tail, long and smooth, like a Danish dog's, a yard long, dun colour. Alyosha, you're cold. You've been in the snow. Would you like some tea? What? Is it cold? Shall I tell her to bring some? C'est un ne pas mettre un chien dehors."
Alyosha ran to the washing stand, wetted the towel, persuaded Ivan to sit down again and put the wet towel round his head. He sat down beside him.
"What were you telling me just now about Lisa?"
Ivan began again. He was becoming very talkative.
"I like Lisa. I said something nasty about her. It was a lie. I like her. I'm afraid for Katya tomorrow. I'm more afraid of her than of anything. On account of the future, she'll cast me off tomorrow and trample me underfoot. She thinks that I'm ruining Mitya from jealousy on her account.
Yes, she thinks that, but it's not so. Tomorrow the cross, but not the gallows. No, I shan't hang myself. Do you know, I can never commit suicide, Alyosha. Is it because I'm base? I'm not a coward. Is it from love of life? How did I know that Smerdyakov had hanged himself? Yes, it was he. Told me so.
And you're quite convinced that there's been someone here? Asked Alyosha.
Yes, on that sofa in the corner. You would have driven him away. You did drive him away. He disappeared when you arrived. I love your face, Alyosha. Did you know that I loved your face? And he is myself, Alyosha. All that's base in me, all that's mean and contemptible. Yes, I am a romantic. He guessed it. Though it's a libel. He is frightfully stupid. But it's to his advantage. He has cunning, animal cunning. He knew how to infuriate me. He kept taunting me with believing in him. And that was how he made me listen to him. He fooled me like a boy. He told me a great deal that was true about myself, though. I should never have owned it to myself. Do you know, Alyosha?
Ivan added, in an intensely earnest and confidential tone.
I should be awfully glad to think that it was he, and not I.
He has worn you out, said Alyosha, looking compassionately at his brother.
He's been teasing me, and you know he does it so cleverly, so cleverly. Conscience, what is conscience? I make it up for myself. Why am I tormented by it? From habit, from the universal habit of mankind for the 7,000 years, so let us give it up, and we shall be gods. It was he said that. It was he said that.
And not you. Not you. Alyosha could not help crying, looking frankly at his brother. Never mind him anyway. Have done with him and forget him. And let him take with him all that you curse now and never come back.
Yes, but he is spiteful. He laughed at me. He was impudent, Alyosha,
Ivan said with a shudder of offence.
But he was unfair to me about lots of things. He told lies about me to my face. Oh, you're going to perform an act of heroic virtue to confess you murdered your father, that the valet murdered him at your instigation.
Brother, Alyosha interposed, restrain yourself. It was not you murdered him. It's not true.
That's what he says, and he knows it. You're going to perform an act of heroic virtue, and you don't believe in virtue. That's what tortures you and makes you angry. That's why you're so vindictive. He said that to me, about me, and he knows what he says.
It's you who say that, not he, exclaimed Alyosha mournfully. And you say it because you're ill and delirious, tormenting yourself.
No, he knows what he says. You're going from pride, he says. You'll stand up and say it was I killed him. And why do you writhe with horror? You're lying. I despise your opinion. I despise your horror. He said that about me. And do you know that you're longing for their praise? He is a criminal, a murderer, but what a generous soul. He wanted to save his brother, and he confessed. That's a lie, Alyosha,
Ivan cried suddenly with flashing eyes.
I don't want the low rabble to praise me. I swear I don't. That's a lie. That's why I threw the glass at him, and it broke against his ugly face.
Brother, calm yourself. Stop, Alyosha entreated him.
Yes, he knows how to torment one. He's cruel,
Ivan went on, unheeding. I had an inkling from the first what he came for. Granting that you go through pride, still you had a hope that Smerdyakov might be convicted and sent to Siberia, and Mitya would be acquitted while you would only be punished with moral condemnation. Do you hear? He laughed then. And some people will praise you, but now Smerdyakov's dead, he's hanged himself, and who'll believe you alone? But yet you are going, you are going, you'll go all the same, you've decided to go.
What are you going for now? That's awful, Alyosha, I can't endure such questions. Who dare ask me such questions?
Brother, interposed Alyosha. His heart sank with terror, but he still seemed to hope to bring Ivan to reason. How could he have told you of Smerdyakov's death before I came, when no one knew of it, and there was no time for anyone to know of it?
He told me,
said Ivan firmly, refusing to admit a doubt.
It was all he did talk about, if you come to that. And it would be all right if you believed in virtue, he said. No matter if they disbelieve you, you're going for the sake of principle. But you are a little pig like Fyodor Pavlovich. And what do you want with virtue? Why do you want to go meddling if your sacrifice is of no use to anyone? Because you don't know yourself why you go.
Oh, you'd give a great deal to know yourself why you go, and can you have made up your mind? You've not made up your mind. You'll sit all night deliberating whether to go or not. But you will go. You know you'll go. You know that whichever way you decide, the decision does not depend on you. You'll go because you won't dare not to go. Why won't you dare? You must guess that for yourself. That's a riddle for you. He got up and went away. You came and he went. He called me a coward, Alyosha. Le mot de l'anime is that I'm a coward. It is not for such eagles to soar above the earth. It was he added that, he? And Smerzhikov said the same, he must be killed. Katya despises me, I've seen that for a month past. Even Lisa will begin to despise me. You're going in order to be praised. That's a brutal lie. And you despise me too, Alyosha. Now I'm going to hate you again, and I hate the monster too. I hate the monster. I don't want to save the monster. Let him rot in Siberia. He's begun singing a hymn. Oh, tomorrow I'll go stand before them and spit in their faces. He jumped up in a frenzy, flung off the towel, and fell to pacing up and down the room again. Alyosha recalled what he just said. I seem to be sleeping awake. I walk, I speak, I see, but I am asleep. It seemed to be just like that now. Alyosha did not leave him. The thought passed through his mind to run for a doctor, but he was afraid to leave his brother alone. There was no one to whom he could leave him. By degrees, Ivan lost consciousness completely at last. He still went on talking incessantly, but quite incoherently, and even articulated his words with difficulty. Suddenly he staggered violently, but Alyosha was in time to support him. Ivan let him lead him to his bed. Alyosha undressed him somehow and put him to bed. He sat watching over him for another 2 hours. The sick man slept soundly without stirring, breathing softly and evenly. Alyosha took a pillow and lay down on the sofa without undressing. As he fell asleep, he prayed for Mitya and Ivan. He began to understand Ivan's illness. The anguish of a proud determination. An earnest conscience. God, in whom he disbelieved, and his truth, were gaining mastery over his heart, which still refused to submit. Yes, the thought floated through Alyosha's head as it lay on the pillow. Yes, if Smerdyakov is dead, no one will believe Ivan's evidence. But he will go and give it. Alyosha smiled softly. God will conquer, he thought. He will either rise up in the light of truth or he'll perish in hate, revenging on himself and on everyone his having served the cause he does not believe in. Alyosha added bitterly, and again he prayed for Ivan. Part 4, Book 12, A Judicial Error. Chapter 1. The fatal day. At 10 o'clock in the morning of the day following the events I've described, the trial of Dmitri Karamazov began in our district court. I hasten to emphasize the fact that I'm far from esteeming myself capable of reporting all that took place at the trial in full detail, or even in the actual order of events. I imagine that to mention everything with full explanation would fill a volume, even a very large one. And so I trust I may not be reproached for confining myself to what struck me. I may have selected as of most interest what was of secondary importance, and may have omitted the most prominent and essential details. But I see I shall do better not to apologize. I will do my best, and the reader will see for himself that I've done all I can. And to begin with, before entering the court, I will mention what surprised me most on that day. Indeed, as it appeared later, everyone was surprised at it too. We all knew that the affair had aroused great interest, that everyone was burning with impatience for the trial to begin, that it had been a subject of talk, conjecture, exclamation and surmise for the last 2 months in local society. Everyone knew, too, that the case had become known throughout Russia, but yet we had not imagined that it had aroused such burning, such intense interest in everyone, not only among ourselves but all over Russia. This became evident at the trial this day. Visitors had arrived not only from the chief town of our province, but from several other Russian towns, as well as from Moscow and Petersburg. Among them were lawyers, ladies, and even several distinguished personages. Every ticket of admission had been snatched up. A special place behind the table at which the three judges sat was set apart for the most distinguished and important of the men visitors. A row of armchairs had been placed there, something exceptional which had never been allowed before. A large proportion, not less than half of the public, were ladies. There was such a large number of lawyers from all parts that they did not know where to seat them, for every ticket had long since been eagerly sought for and distributed. I saw, at the end of the room, behind the platform, a special partition hurriedly put up, behind which all these lawyers were admitted, and they thought themselves lucky to have standing room there, for all chairs had been removed for the sake of space, and the crowd behind the partition stood throughout the case, closely packed, shoulder to shoulder. Some of the ladies, especially those who came from a distance, made their appearance in the gallery very smartly dressed, but the majority of the ladies were oblivious even of dress. Their faces betrayed hysterical, intense, almost morbid curiosity. A peculiar fact, established afterwards by many observations, was that almost all the ladies, or at least the vast majority of them, were on Mitya's side, and in favour of his being acquitted. This was perhaps chiefly owing to his reputation as a conqueror of female hearts. It was known that two women rivals were to appear in the case. One of them, Katerina Ivanovna, was an object of general interest. All sorts of extraordinary tales were told about her, amazing anecdotes of her passion for Mitya, in spite of his crime. Her pride and aristocratic connections were particularly insisted upon. She had called upon scarcely anyone in the town. People said she intended to petition the government for leave to accompany the criminal to Siberia and to be married to him somewhere in the mines. The appearance of Grushenka in court was awaited with no less impatience. The public was looking forward with anxious curiosity to the meeting of the two rivals, the proud, aristocratic girl and the hetaira. But Grushenka was a more familiar figure to the ladies of the district than Katerina Ivanovna. They had already seen the woman who had ruined Fyodor Pavlovich and his unhappy son. And all, almost without exception, wondered how father and son could be so in love with such a very common, ordinary Russian girl who was not even pretty. In brief, there was a great deal of talk. I know for a fact that there were several serious family quarrels on Mitch's account in our town. Many ladies quarrelled violently with their husbands over differences of opinion about the dreadful case. And it was only natural that the husbands of these ladies, far from being favourably disposed to the prisoner, should enter the court bitterly prejudiced against him. In fact, one may say pretty certainly that the masculine, as distinguished from the feminine part of the audience, were biased against the prisoner. There were numbers of severe, frowning, even vindictive faces. Mitya, indeed, had managed to offend many people during his stay in the town. Some of the visitors were, of course, in excellent spirits and quite unconcerned as to the fate of Mitya personally. But all were interested in the trial, and the majority of the men were certainly hoping for the conviction of the criminal, except perhaps the lawyers, who were more interested in the legal than in the moral aspect of the case. Everybody was excited at the presence of the celebrated lawyer, Fetyukovich. His talent was well known, and this was not the first time he had defended notorious criminal cases in the provinces. And if he defended them, such cases became celebrated, and long remembered all over Russia. There were stories, too, about our prosecutor and about the president of the court. It was said that Ippolit Kirillovich was in a tremor at meeting Fetyukovich, and that they had been enemies from the beginning of their careers in Petersburg. That though our sensitive prosecutor, who always considered that he had been aggrieved by someone in Petersburg because his talents had not been properly appreciated, was keenly excited over the Karamazov case, and was even dreaming of rebuilding his flagging fortunes by means of it. Fetyukovich, they said, was his one anxiety. But these rumours were not quite just. Our prosecutor was not one of those men who lose heart in face of danger. On the contrary, his self-confidence increased with the increase of danger. It must be noted that our prosecutor was in general too hasty and morbidly impressionable. He would put his whole soul into some case and work at it as though his whole fate and his whole fortune depended on its result. This was the subject of some ridicule in the legal world, for just by this characteristic our prosecutor had gained a wider notoriety than could have been expected from his modest position. People laughed particularly at his passion for psychology. In my opinion they were wrong, and our prosecutor was, I believe, a character of greater depth than was generally supposed. But with his delicate health he had failed to make his mark at the outset of his career, and had never made up for it later. As for the president of our court, I can only say that he was a humane and cultured man, who had a practical knowledge of his work and progressive views. He was rather ambitious, but did not concern himself greatly about his future career. The great aim of his life was to be a man of advanced ideas. He was, too, a man of connections and property. He felt, as we learned afterwards, rather strongly about the Karamazov case, but from a social, not from a personal standpoint. He was interested in it as a social phenomenon, in its classification and its character as a product of our social conditions, as typical of the national character, and so on, and so on. His attitude to the personal aspect of the case, to its tragic significance and the persons involved in it, including the prisoner, was rather indifferent and abstract, as was perhaps fitting, indeed. The court was packed and overflowing long before the judges made their appearance. Our court is the best hall in the town, spacious, lofty, and good for sound. On the right of the judges, who were on a raised platform, a table and two rows of chairs had been put ready for the jury. On the left was the place for the prisoner and the counsel for the defence. In the middle of the court, near the judges, was a table with the material proofs. On it lay Fyodor Pavlovich's white silk dressing gown, stained with blood, the fatal brass pestle with which the supposed murder had been committed, Mitya's shirt with a blood-stained sleeve, his coat stained with blood in patches over the pocket in which he'd put his handkerchief, the handkerchief itself stiff with blood and by now quite yellow, the pistol loaded by Mitya at Perhotin's with a view to suicide, and taken from him on the sly at Mokroe by Trifon Borisovitch, the envelope in which the 3,000 rubles had been put ready for Grushenka, the narrow pink ribbon with which it had been tied, and many other articles I don't remember. In the body of the hall at some distance came the seats for the public, but in front of the balustrade a few chairs had been placed for witnesses who remained in the court after giving their evidence. At 10 o'clock the three judges arrived, the president, one honorary justice of the peace, and one other. The prosecutor, of course, entered immediately after. The president was a short, stout, thick-set man of 50, with a dyspeptic complexion, dark hair turning grey and cut short, and a red ribbon, of what order I don't remember. The prosecutor struck me and the others, too, as looking particularly pale, almost green. His face seemed to have grown suddenly thinner, perhaps in a single night, for I'd seen him looking as usual only 2 days before. The president began with asking the court whether all the jury were present. But I see I can't go on like this, partly because some things I did not hear, others I did not notice, and others I've forgotten, but most of all because, as I've said before, I have literally no time or space to mention everything that was said and done. I only know that neither side objected to very many of the jurymen. I remember the 12 jurymen. 4 were petty officials of the town, 2 were merchants, and 6 peasants and artisans of the town. I remember, long before the trial, questions were continually asked with some surprise, especially by ladies. Can such a delicate, complex, and psychological case be submitted for decision to petty officials and even peasants? And what can an official, still more a peasant, understand in such an affair? All the 4 officials in the jury were, in fact, men of no consequence and of low rank. Except one who was rather younger, they were grey-headed men, little known in society, who had vegetated on a pitiful salary, and who probably had elderly, unpresentable wives and crowds of children, perhaps even without shoes and stockings. At most, they spent their leisure over cards, and of course had never read a single book. The two merchants looked respectable, but were strangely silent and stolid. One of them was close-shaven and was dressed in European style. The other had a small grey beard and wore a red ribbon with some sort of a medal upon it, on his neck. There's no need to speak of the artisans and the peasants. The artisans of Skoto-Prigonyevsk are almost peasants and even work on the land. Two of them also wore European dress, and perhaps for that reason were dirtier and more uninviting-looking than the others. So that one might well wonder, as I did as soon as I'd looked at them, what men like that could possibly make of such a case. Yet their faces made a strangely imposing, almost menacing impression. They were stern and frowning. At last the president opened the case of the murder of Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. I don't quite remember how he described him. The court usher was told to bring in the prisoner, and Mitya made his appearance. There was a hush through the court. One could have heard a fly. I don't know how it was with others, but Mitya made a most unfavourable impression on me. He looked an awful dandy in a brand new frock coat. I heard afterwards that he'd ordered it in Moscow, expressly for the occasion from his own tailor, who had his measure. He wore immaculate black kid gloves and exquisite linen. He walked in with his yard-long strides, looking stiffly straight in front of him, and sat down in his place with a most unperturbed air. At the same moment the counsel for defence, the celebrated Futyukovich, entered, and a sort of subdued hum passed through the court. He was a tall, spare man with long, thin legs, with extremely long, thin, pale fingers, clean-shaven face, demurely brushed, rather short hair, and thin lips that were at times curved into something between a sneer and a smile. He looked about 40. His face would have been pleasant if it had not been for his eyes, which, in themselves small and inexpressive, were set remarkably close together, with only the thin, long nose as a dividing line between them. In fact, there was something strikingly bird-like about his face. He was in evening dress and white tie. I remember the president's first questions to Mitya about his name, his calling, and so on. Mitya answered sharply, and his voice was so unexpectedly loud that it made the president start and look at the prisoner with surprise. Then followed a list of persons who were to take part in the proceedings, that is, of the witnesses and experts. It was a long list. Four of the witnesses were not present. Yusov, who had given evidence at the preliminary inquiry, but was now in Paris. Madame Holakov and Maximov, who were absent through illness, and Smerdyakov through his sudden death, of which an official statement from the police was presented. The news of Smerdyakov's death produced a sudden stir and whisper in the court. Many of the audience, of course, had not heard of the sudden suicide. What struck people most was Mitya's sudden outburst. As soon as the statement of Smerdyakov's death was made, he cried out aloud from his place, "He was a dog, and died like a dog." I remember how his counsel rushed to him, and how the president addressed him, threatening to take stern measures if such an irregularity were repeated. Mitya nodded, and in a subdued voice repeated several times abruptly to his counsel, with no show of regret, "I won't again. I won't. It escaped me. I won't do it again." And of course this brief episode did him no good with the jury or the public. His character was displayed, and it spoke for itself. It was under the influence of this incident that the opening statement was read. It was rather short, but circumstantial. It only stated the chief reason why he had been arrested, why he must be tried, and so on. Yet it made a great impression on me. The clerk read it loudly and distinctly. The whole tragedy was suddenly unfolded before us, concentrated in bold relief in a fatal and pitiless light. I remember how immediately after it had been read, the president asked Mitya in a loud, impressive voice, "Prisoner, do you plead guilty?" Mitya suddenly rose from his seat. "I plead guilty to drunkenness and dissipation," he exclaimed, again in a startling, almost frenzied voice, "to idleness and debauchery. I meant to become an honest man for good, just at the moment when I was struck down by fate. But I am not guilty of the death of that old man, my enemy and my father. No, I am not guilty of robbing him. I could not be. Dmitri Karamazov is a scoundrel, but not a thief." He sat down again, visibly trembling all over. The president again, briefly but impressively, admonished him to answer only what was asked, and not to go off into irrelevant exclamations. Then he ordered the case to proceed. All the witnesses were led up to take the oath. Then I saw them all together. The brothers of the prisoner were, however, allowed to give evidence without taking the oath. After an exhortation from the priest and the president, the witnesses were led away and were made to sit as far as possible apart from one another. Then they began calling them up one by one. This book is continued on Disc 4. Chapter 6. Why is such a man alive? Dmitri Fyodorovitch, a young man of 28, of medium height and agreeable countenance, looked older than his years. He was muscular and showed signs of considerable physical strength. Yet there was something not healthy in his face. It was rather thin. His cheeks were hollow, and there was an unhealthy sallowness in their colour. His rather large, prominent, dark eyes had an expression of firm determination, and yet there was a vague look in them, too. Even when he was excited and talking irritably, his eyes somehow did not follow his mood, but betrayed something else, something quite incongruous with what was passing. "It's hard to tell what he's thinking," those who talked to him sometimes declared. People who saw something pensive and sullen in his eyes were startled by his sudden laugh, which bore witness to mirthful and light-hearted thoughts, at the very time when his eyes were so gloomy. A certain strained look in his face was easy to understand at this moment. Everyone knew, or had heard, of the extremely restless and dissipated life which he had been leading of late, as well as of the violent anger to which he had been roused in his quarrels with his father. There were several stories current in the town about it. It is true that he was irascible by nature, of an unstable and unbalanced mind, as our Justice of the Peace, Kachalnikov, happily described him. He was stylishly and irreproachably dressed in a carefully buttoned frock coat. He wore black gloves and carried a top hat. Having only lately left the army, he still had moustaches and no beard. His dark brown hair was cropped short and combed forward on his temples. He had the long, determined stride of a military man. He stood still for a moment on the threshold, and glancing at the whole party, went straight up to the elder, guessing him to be their host. He made him a low bow and asked his blessing. Father Zosima, rising in his chair, blessed him. Dmitri kissed his hand respectfully, and with intense feeling, almost anger, he said, "Be so generous as to forgive me for having kept you waiting so long. But Smerdyakov, the valet sent me by my father in reply to my inquiries, told me twice over that the appointment was for one. Now I suddenly learn—" "Don't disturb yourself," interposed the elder. "No matter. You are a little late. It's of no consequence. I'm extremely obliged to you, and expected no less from your goodness." Saying this, Dmitri bowed once more, then turning suddenly towards his father, made him too a similarly low and respectful bow. He had evidently considered it beforehand, and made this bow in all seriousness, thinking it his duty to show his respect and good intentions. Although Fyodor Pavlovich was taken unawares, he was equal to the occasion. In response to Dmitri's bow, he jumped up from his chair and made his son a bow as low in return. His face was suddenly solemn and impressive, which gave him a positively malignant look. Dmitri bowed generally to all present, and without a word walked to the window with his long, resolute stride, sat down on the only empty chair near Father Paisi, and, bending forward, prepared to listen to the conversation he had interrupted. Dmitri's entrance had taken no more than 2 minutes, and the conversation was resumed. But this time Miouzov thought it unnecessary to reply to Father Pais's persistent and almost irritable question.
"Allow me to withdraw from this discussion," he observed, with a certain well-bred nonchalance. "It's a subtle question, too. Here, Ivan Fyodorovich is smiling at us. He must have something interesting to say about that also. Ask him."
"Nothing special, except one little remark," Ivan replied at once. "European liberals in general, and even our liberal dilettanti, often mix up the final results of socialism with those of Christianity. This wild notion is, of course, a characteristic feature. But it's not only liberals and dilettanti who mix up socialism and Christianity. But in many cases, it appears, the police, the foreign police, of course, do the same. Your Paris anecdote is rather to the point, Pyotr Alexandrovich."
"I ask your permission to drop this subject altogether," Miouzov repeated. "I will tell you instead, gentlemen, another interesting and rather characteristic anecdote of Ivan Fyodorovich himself. Only 5 days ago, in a gathering here, principally of ladies, he solemnly declared in an argument that there was nothing in the whole world to make men love their neighbors, that there was no law of nature that man should love mankind, and that if there had been any love on earth hitherto, it was not owing to a natural law, but simply because men have believed in immortality. Ivan Fyodorovich added in parenthesis that the whole natural law lies in that faith, and that if you were to destroy in mankind the belief in immortality, not only love, but every living force maintaining the life of the world would at once be dried up. Moreover, nothing then would be immoral. Everything would be lawful, even cannibalism. That's not all," he ended by asserting that for every individual like ourselves, who does not believe in God or immortality, the moral law of nature must immediately be changed into the exact contrary of the former religious law, and that egoism, even to crime, must become not only lawful, but even recognized as the inevitable, the most rational, even honorable outcome of his position. From this paradox, gentlemen, you can judge of the rest of our eccentric and paradoxical friend Ivan Fyodorovich's theories." "Excuse me," Dmitri cried suddenly. "If I've heard aright, crime must not only be permitted, but even recognized as the inevitable and the most rational outcome of his position for every infidel. Is that so or not?"
"Quite so," said Father Paisi.
"I remember it."
Having uttered these words, Dmitri ceased speaking as suddenly as he had begun. Everyone looked at him with curiosity.
"Is that really your conviction as to the consequences of the disappearance of the faith in immortality?"
the elder asked Ivan suddenly.
"Yes, that was my contention. There is no virtue if there's no immortality."
"You are blessed in believing that, or else most unhappy."
"Why unhappy?" Ivan asked, smiling.
"Because, in all probability, you don't believe yourself in the immortality of your soul, nor in what you have written yourself in your article on church jurisdiction."
"Perhaps you are right, but I wasn't altogether joking," Ivan suddenly and strangely confessed, flushing quickly.
"You were not altogether joking. That's true. The question is still fretting your heart and not answered. But the martyr likes sometimes to divert himself with his despair, as it were, driven to it by despair itself. Meanwhile, in your despair, you, too, divert yourself with magazine articles and discussions in society. Though you don't believe your own arguments, and with an aching heart, mock at them inwardly. That question you have not answered, and it is your great grief, for it clamours for an answer."
"But can it be answered by me, answered in the affirmative?"
Ivan went on asking strangely, still looking at the elder with the same inexplicable smile.
"If it can't be decided in the affirmative, it will never be decided in the negative. You know that that is the peculiarity of your heart, and all its suffering is due to it. But think the Creator who had given you a lofty heart capable of such suffering,
of thinking and seeking higher things. For our dwelling is in the heavens. God grant that your heart will attain the answer on earth, and may God bless your path.
The elder raised his hand and would have made the sign of the cross over Ivan from where he stood, but the latter rose from his seat, went up to him, received his blessing, and, kissing his hand, went back to his place in silence. His face looked firm and earnest. This action and all the preceding conversation, which was so surprising from Ivan, impressed everyone by its strangeness and a certain solemnity, so that all were silent for a moment, and there was a look almost of apprehension in Alyosha's face. But Miusov suddenly shrugged his shoulders, and at the same moment Fyodor Pavlovich jumped up from his seat.
"Most pious and holy elder," he cried, pointing to Ivan, "that is my son, flesh of my flesh, the dearest of my flesh. He is my most dutiful Karl Moor, so to speak, while this son who has just come in, Dmitri, against whom I am seeking justice from you, is the undutiful Franz Moor. They are both out of Schiller's Robbers, and so I am the reigning Count von Moor. Judge and save us. We need not only your prayers, but your prophecies." "Speak without buffoonery, and don't begin by insulting the members of your family,"
answered the elder in a faint, exhausted voice. He was obviously getting more and more fatigued, and his strength was failing. The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Disc 4. Chapter 2. Dangerous Witnesses. I do not know whether the witnesses for the defense and for the prosecution were separated into groups by the president, and whether it was arranged to call them in certain order, but no doubt it was so. I only know that the witnesses for the prosecution were called first. I repeat, I don't intend to describe all the questions step by step. Besides, my account would be to some extent superfluous, because in the speeches for the prosecution and for the defense, the whole course of the evidence was brought together and set in a strong and significant light. And I took down parts of those two remarkable speeches in full, and will quote them in due course, together with one extraordinary and quite unexpected episode, which occurred before the final speeches, and undoubtedly influenced the sinister and fatal outcome of the trial. I will only observe that from the first moments of the trial, one peculiar characteristic of the case was conspicuous and observed by all. That is, the overwhelming strength of the prosecution, as compared with the arguments the defense had to rely upon. Everyone realized it from the first moment, that the facts began to group themselves round a single point, and the whole horrible and bloody crime was gradually revealed. Everyone, perhaps, felt from the first that the case was beyond dispute, that there was no doubt about it, that there could be really no discussion, and that the defense was only a matter of form, and that the prisoner was guilty, obviously and conclusively guilty. I imagine that even the ladies, who were so impatiently longing for the acquittal of the interesting prisoner, were at the same time, without exception, convinced of his guilt. What's more, I believe they would have been mortified if his guilt had not been so firmly established, as that would have lessened the effect of the closing scene of the criminal's acquittal. That he would be acquitted, all the ladies, strange to say, were firmly persuaded up to the very last moment. He is guilty, but he will be acquitted from motives of humanity in accordance with the new ideas, the new sentiments that had come into fashion, and so on and so on. And that was why they'd crowded into the court so impatiently. The men were more interested in the contest between the prosecutor and the famous Fetyukovich. All were wondering and asking themselves what could even a talent like Fetyukovich's make of such a desperate case. And so they followed his achievements step by step with concentrated attention. But Fetyukovich remained an enigma to all up to the very end, up to his speech. Persons of experience suspected that he had some design, that he was working towards some object, but it was almost impossible to guess what it was. His confidence and self-reliance were unmistakable, however. Everyone noticed with pleasure, moreover, that he, after so short a stay, not more than 3 days, perhaps, among us, had so wonderfully succeeded in mastering the case and had studied it to a nicety. People described with relish afterwards how cleverly he had
taken down all the witnesses for the prosecution, and as far as possible perplexed them, and what's more, had aspersed their reputation and so depreciated the value of their evidence. But it was supposed that he did this rather by way of sport, so to speak, for professional glory, to show nothing had been omitted of the accepted methods, for all were convinced that he could do no real good by such disparagement of the witnesses, and probably was more aware of this than anyone, having some idea of his own in the background, some concealed weapon of defence, which he would suddenly reveal when the time came. But meanwhile, conscious of his strength, he seemed to be diverting himself. So, for instance, when Grigory, Fyodor Pavlovich's old servant, who had given the most damning piece of evidence about the open door, was examined, the counsel for the defence positively fastened upon him when his turn came to question him. It must be noted that Grigory entered the hall with a composed and almost stately air, not the least disconcerted by the majesty of the court, or the vast audience listening to him. He gave evidence with as much confidence as though he'd been talking with his Marfa, only perhaps more respectfully. It was impossible to make him contradict himself. The prosecutor questioned him first in detail about the family life of the Karamazovs. The family picture stood out in lurid colours. It was plain to ear and eye that the witness was guileless and impartial. In spite of his profound reverence for the memory of his deceased master, he yet bore witness that he had been unjust to Mitya, and hadn't brought up his children as he should. He'd have been devoured by lice when he was little if it hadn't been for me. He added, describing Mitya's early childhood, it wasn't fair either of the father to wrong his son over his mother's property, which was by right his. In reply to the prosecutor's question what grounds he had for asserting that Fyodor Pavlovich had wronged his son in their money relations, Grigory, to the surprise of everyone, had no proof at all to bring forward, but he still persisted that the arrangement with the son was unfair, and that he ought to have paid him several thousand roubles more. I must note, by the way, that the prosecutor asked this question, whether Fyodor Pavlovich had really kept back part of Mitya's inheritance, with marked persistence of all the witnesses who could be asked it, not excepting Alyosha and Ivan. But he obtained no exact information from anyone. All alleged that it was so, but were unable to bring forward any distinct proof. Grigory's description of the scene at the dinner table, when Dmitri had burst in and beaten his father, threatening to come back to kill him, made a sinister impression on the court, especially as the old servant's composure in telling it, his parsimony of words and peculiar phraseology, were as effective as eloquence. He observed that he was not angry with Mitya for having knocked him down and struck him on the face. He'd forgiven him long ago, he said. Of the deceased Smeryakov, he observed, crossing himself, that he was a lad of ability, but stupid and afflicted, and worse still, an infidel, and that it was Fyodor Pavlovich and his elder son who had taught him to be so. But he defended Smeryakov's honesty almost with warmth, and related how Smeryakov had once found the master's money in the yard, and instead of concealing it, had taken it to his master, who had rewarded him with a gold piece for it, and trusted him implicitly from that time forward. He maintained obstinately that the door into the garden had been open, but he was asked so many questions that I can't recall them all. At last the counsel for the defence began to cross-examine him, and the first question he asked was about the envelope in which Fyodor Pavlovich was supposed to have put 3,000 roubles for a certain person. "Have you ever seen it? You, who were for so many years in close attendance on your master?" Grigory answered that he'd not seen it, and had never heard of the money from anyone, till everybody was talking about it. This question about the envelope Fetyukovich put to everyone who could conceivably have known of it, as persistently as the prosecutor asked his question about Dmitri's inheritance, and got the same answer from all, that no one had seen the envelope, though many had heard of it. From the beginning, everyone noticed Fetyukovich's persistence on this subject. "Now, with your permission, I'll ask you a question," Fetyukovich said suddenly and unexpectedly. "What was that balsam, or other decoction, made, which, as we learn from the preliminary inquiry, you used on that evening to rub your lumbago, in the hope of curing it.
Grigory looked blankly at the questioner, and after a brief silence muttered,
"There was saffron in it." "Nothing but saffron. Don't you remember any other ingredient?" "There was milfoil in it, too." "And pepper, perhaps?"
Fetyukovich queried.
"Yes, there was pepper, too." "Etc." "And all dissolved in vodka?"